I'm Coach Mickey.
And I'm Mel.
And we're so glad that you joined us. And thank you for joining us on Coach Mickey, Mel, and Friends. And if this is your first time joining us, come on in and make yourself comfortable. Grab a cup of coffee, a hot tea, or whatever beverage you're drinking in the world. And make yourself comfortable, because this is going to be a fun one and an intriguing one. You guys are going to be on the edge of your seat for this one today. Yes. And for those of you that join us on a regular basis, thank you so much. We appreciate you. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate you interacting with not only us, but our guests and supporting them. And reaching out to them, and also giving your insight and also comments of how much you've enjoyed hearing them. So thank you so much. And today I'm really excited, because this is something that really intrigued me when I was reading this person's bio. And you guys are, you're just in for a great story. You are just in for an amazing story. So I'm going to start right from the beginning. He is a graduate of UCLA. He lives in Southern California. And he began his quest to learn about World War II and the experiences of his father, pilot Howard Snyder, and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. It became his passion, and after 4.5 years of dedicated research, it resulted into his book, Shot Down, which has received many, many book awards, 25 to be exact. Steve is on the board of directors and the past president of the 306th Bomb Group Historical Society, and on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society. He is extremely busy, where he is attending air shows and signing copies of his book and sharing his story. And we are excited to have you. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve Snyder, the author of Shot Down. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, we are happy to have you. And I, like I told you prior to the podcast, I am a huge World War II history buff. So when I started to read your bio and your information, a lot of this intrigued me. And that's why I think this is going to be an incredible podcast for you to share your story, because some of the elements of this is not like other World War II history stories at all. But I got to ask, so how did you begin to write your book? How did all of this start?
Oh, gosh. Well, growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. And he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And he flew bombing missions over Europe. And in February of 1944, his plane was shot down. And he was after he bailed out, he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture by the Germans and got back to England. But it wasn't until I retired from a career in sales and sales management in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And my parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and maybe learn some more details. And at that time, I had no intention of writing a book whatsoever. But there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down, which is absolutely riveting, that's in the book. And the other were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England. And sitting down and reading those letters was just fascinating, because he was very candid in those letters. He wrote about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the air base in England, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And I just became fascinated with the whole story, became my passion. And I started doing all this research, going on the internet, reading books about the air war, contacting relatives of his crew members. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique that it had to be told. People needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book.
Wow. That's a lot of information. And you've got a lot of insight information, because we always hear the surface stuff of World War II. You know, this happened, they were here. But to know and learn the background and the story of someone's actual journey while being there in real time, that's what's incredible about it. And there's so much more to it. So please hang on, Circle of Friends, because this is going to get even better. I want to back up a little bit with your dad being there. So can you kind of give us a little bit of tidbits of what had happened when his plane was shot down?
Sure. It was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany, on February 8th of 1944. and they dropped their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire, what was called FLAC. FLAC was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And they couldn't get their bomb bay doors back up. And so as a result, they lost airspeed. They started falling behind the bomber formation, which was heading back to their bases in England. And they were singled out by two German fighter planes, the Focke-Wulf 190s. And like wolves or lions on prey, they swooped in to my dad's plane, who was, you know, lagging behind. It was kind of all alone. And then the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. A B-17 had a 10-man crew. Two of the crew members were killed in the plane. The other eight bailed out successfully. But both the German planes were shot down at the same time. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and his plane crashed, and he was killed. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. During my research, one day my wife said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I'm thinking to myself, oh, she's so naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. It's a ridiculous idea. It'd be impossible to find him. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war and speaks perfect English. So he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force.
Oh, my God. Wow. So not only did you have the story of what happened with us here in the United States with your dad, you have got the other perspective from a German side.
Right. Exactly. So the book goes into detail. The first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down. And then the second half of the book goes into detail about what happened afterwards. And it's just not about my dad, but it's about what happened to each member of the crew, because something different happened to each guy. Of the 10-man crew, five of them made it home, but five of them did not. And then also it's about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives to help my dad and other members of his crew who bailed out to try to evade being captured by the Germans.
Didn't you? I was looking in your information when I was reading. There is a huge element of these people that, you know, he stayed at their houses any time from what, one day to 1 week, and he just bounced from place to place just to survive. And how long of a time frame was that he did that when he was in Belgium?
It was 7 months. But after my dad bailed out, he came down in some trees right at the French-Belgian border. And his parachute got hung up at the branches and he couldn't get down. He was dangling 20 feet off the ground. But a couple young Belgian men came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. And they helped him down and they took him back to those two men's name were Henri Franken and Raymond Durvan. They took him back to the Durvan farmhouse and he stayed there one night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that because there were German patrols combing the area looking for him. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came and got him and take him to a safer location. And like you said, after that, he was moved from place to place. He might stay one night, might spend 6 weeks. It all depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. And so he moved all around for 7 months and he was hidden. And the people hit my dad or any airman who bailed out for that matter were unbelievably courageous and brave people, because if the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, those people would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to a concentration camp or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. So they were wonderful people. And as you mentioned, my dad was some of the people that he stayed with lengthy periods of time and built up a friendship. You know, they kept in contact after the war.
Wow. Now, you've had an opportunity to travel multiple times back to Belgium. I had seen that you had traveled. How many of these people or these families have you had an opportunity to meet in person?
Well, my first trip to Belgium, I've been there six times, was in 1994, when my wife and I and my sister accompanied my parents to the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and of my dad's plane being shot down. And that's really when it really became personal for me, because I went around and saw these places where my dad was hidden, where other events took place. And I was able to meet Nellie Tilcan, the wife of that customs officer, Paul Tilcan. Paul had died a couple months after he helped my dad. He was arrested by the Gestapo and sent to prison, tortured, and narrowly escaped being executed. But he died a few years later as a result of the seriousness of the beatings that he took. But I did meet his wife, and I have become friends with some of the relatives or descendants of other Belgian people who helped my dad. So I've made some wonderful lifelong relationships and friendships with Belgian people, and I just love going over there.
That's incredible. I mean, and just that alone, just the compassion, and like you said, to take that risk, you know, for someone, I mean, that tells you the heart. Plus, it was such a difficult time back then. I mean, huge, nothing that we can possibly imagine now in this time frame, but just to do that during that time frame and take that risk is amazing. I want to back up to also, so I got to get back to the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane. I got to ask how that conversation started. How did that even transpire? I mean, how do you even approach something like that?
Yeah. Well, I went on Google trying to find a German Luftwaffe pilot, and a couple forums came up, and I joined them, and I posted an inquiry, you know, because I knew the day that my dad's plane was shot down, the location where he shot down, the time of day where he was shot down. And after I posted those inquiries, in 1 week, two guys got back to me, one from England and one from Belgium. And I found out that on that day, there were 12 B-17s shot down. Oh. And the one shot down south of Chimay, Belgium, right at the French-Belgium border, was shot down by Hans Berger. And the guy from Belgium that contacted me was actually a Luftwaffe historian and had written a number of books. And he knew Hans Berger, and because he included Hans in his books. And he told me that Hans could speak English. And he contacted Hans and found out if it'd be okay if I contacted Hans. And he said it was okay. And I was just excited beyond belief when I found Hans. And for the book, I interviewed him over the internet and through over telephone conversations. And I just bombarded him with questions. At one point, goes, you know, Steve, I really don't know you that well, and you're asking me all these personal questions. But I, you know, built up a trust with him, and like I said, he gave me unbelievably detailed information about the war. And then on two of my trips to Belgium later on, after I wrote the book, I went to Munich, Germany, where Hans lives. And met with him in person and had a wonderful time. It's interesting that of all the people involved in the shot down story, Hans Berger is the only one that's still living.
Wow.
He's 98 years old now, and he was shot down three times himself. So most of his friends died in the war. And we became friends. I felt a personal connection with him because at one point in time, my dad's life and Hans' life crossed paths. So he's a part of my dad's story, a part of his life. And World War II was the defining moment of my dad's life. I mean, nothing else could come close to matching that. And Hans was pretty much just like a U.S. airman. He was a young guy, 19, 20 years old, fighting for his country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. He said it was unfortunate that they had to be shooting at each other, but that was war.
Yeah. Yeah. How much of a difference did you find in his story comparable to your dad's? Because, you know, here, like you said, you're talking about another 19-year-old guy that's doing the same job. It's just that they're on the other side. How much of a connection was there? I mean, or similarity, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. And how much of a difference was there? And besides just the fact that one was German and one was American?
Well, the Hans was part of the Luftwaffe, that they certain units that were defending the Reich, the Third Reich, Germany, from all the bombing attacks by the U.S. and Britain. Britain bombed at night, and the Americans bombed during the day. So they bombed Germany around the clock. And Hans said it was overwhelming. He said he was absolutely scared to death, because he would go up and there'd be these bomber formations of hundreds of bombers, you know, attacking at a time. And these bombers had 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns. They could put out a tremendous amount of firepower. Plus, the American bombers were escorted by all these U.S. fighters. So the German fighter planes were outnumbered by a great deal by the bombers and the U.S. fighters. So he said he was scared to death. It was very daunting going up. I think the only reason he survived the war is that at the beginning of 1945, the last year of the war in Europe, he was pulled out of combat to become a test pilot for the HE Henkel 162 German single-engine jet fighter they were trying to perfect, which they never really did. But that got him out of combat, and that basically saved his life and the reason that he even made it through the war.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. Just the story alone is incredible. It really is. Because you don't think about the other side. You know, we think about taking care of our own and doing what we need to do. But again, these are still the same, you know, they're people, you know, they got families, they've got, you know, kids, they're doing the same thing. Again, it's just, like you said, it's war.
Right.
I want to get to the letters that that your dad wrote. What was some of the most interesting things that surprised you when you were reading the letters while he was overseas doing what he was doing? Was there anything that stuck out that really, really resonated with you while he was over there?
Well, you know, my parents had this box of letters, and you know, I never read them until after they both passed away. One day I sat down and opened this box and started reading these letters, and I had no idea that they were so detailed. But of course, my dad expressed, you know, the love for his wife, because they'd only been married for 2 years at the time that he went overseas. And then my sister Susan was 1 year old when he went overseas. And then when my dad went overseas, my mother was pregnant with her second child. And he didn't know whether he had a boy or a girl until he came back to England after he was missing in action, because my other sister Nancy was born while he was missing in action. It's interesting that every time he referred to the baby in the letters, he always called the baby Steve or Stevie. But it turned out to be Nancy, and I didn't come along until after the war. But just the detail that he went into, you know, talking about, you know, because, you know, Britain had been in the war, England had been in the war for a couple of years before the U.S. Air Force went over in 42. And England has suffered lots of bombings by the Germans, and they were had on the blackout curfews. And when they go into London, he couldn't see a thing. They get lost all the time because there were blackouts, and just the personal details that he talked about of his crew members going on leave, and like I said, what life was like in England and London at the time, and what these bombing missions were like. And at first, how scared he was when he first went up for these missions, but then he kind of got used to it. Also, you know, back then, the nation was much more religious and Christian based than it is today. And not only the letters that my dad wrote or my mother wrote, but also relatives of the other members of the crew, you know, they depended a great deal on their faith and their belief in God to get them through this, and praying that their loved ones would come home. As I mentioned, five of the crew came home, and all those families were you know, joyful, but five of the crew did not come home. And it was devastating to lose these young guys that are in their late teens or early 20s.
Yeah.
So just all the compassion and the emotion that these people had. I mean, there was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. And back then, there was no telegrams. There was no internet. You know, you only could communicate by letters that you'd have to wait and wait to receive. So it was an amazing period in time.
Was your dad, was he able to write to your mom when he was in hiding through Belgium? Like, did she have any idea that he was still alive, or was she under the impression he was just missing in action and he couldn't, you know, could he not contact her?
That's a very good question. As I mentioned, he was shot down on February 8th, and on February 23rd, all the relatives or the close relatives, you know, wives or mothers, received a telegram from the War Department saying that the Susan Ruth was shot down, and then the entire crew was missing in action. And that's all my mother ever knew until my dad got back to England, you know, in September, late September, and sent her a Western Union telegram saying, you know, fit as a fiddle, honey.
Oh, wow.
Keep that pretty little chin up and bank the money, because he had all that back pay coming. Three of the crewmen who bailed out were captured immediately and became prisoners of war. And they were able to write letters occasionally back home. So the family members knew that these three guys survived, and they were in prisoner of war camps. Two of them were very seriously injured, and that two of the crew had been killed in the plane. But they didn't know what happened to the five other members. The families were just hoping that they would hear some good news. But for five of the crewmen, no one knew what happened to them until the war ended. My dad and another crewman, the tail gunner, Bill Schlenker, they both evaded. Bill Schlenker, unlike my dad, he was hidden by one family, a woman and her two daughters, the entire 7 months, as opposed to my dad being moved from place to place and to place. But once the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day and liberated that area of Belgium, you know, that's when they hooked up with the U.S. Army. And when they got back to England, were able to send telegrams back indicating letting their families know that they were safe. One thing that was really unique about my dad is that he got tired of hiding. And, you know, he almost got discovered by the Germans several times. And when word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on D-Day, he decided to get back in the fight. So he actually came out of hiding and joined the French resistance. And for 2.5 months, sabotaged German convoys. Then he just hooked up with the U.S. armies when they came to that area on September 2nd. In Treslong, France. So that was very unique for a U.S. airman to actually fight with the French resistance.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you had a chance to meet any of these people from France? Have you talked to any of them, or have they passed?
They've all passed. What's really wonderful, though, is that there's so many buildings, farmhouses, and places where the events took place that you can visit today and see where history took place. The farmhouse where my dad and this resistance group stayed just across the border in northern France is still there today. Different homes and places. So it's really amazing. In fact, I've put together a whole PowerPoint presentation. I have several PowerPoint presentations that I make, and one of them is just about all the places you can go see where all this all took place.
So you've actually almost walked the map of to where he was shot down to where he ended up, where he was actually reunited with the U.S. soldiers. So you've kind of gone through that whole thing in his footsteps, through your PowerPoint presentation, through your book. And so from beginning to end, you kind of tell the whole story on how all of this transpired. How incredible was it to go and do this and know that all these events had happened, and then again to meet these people on this journey? It must have been, I can't even imagine what the feeling was like, Steve. I'm going to let you tell the story. How did it feel when you got there to see all this and make it became real?
Well, you just asking me that question brings goosebumps to me and chills again, because every time I'd go to one of these places, it would just be amazing. This one house in Charleroi, where he stayed for lengthy periods of time, which I've been to a few times, but on one of the occasions, this man opens the window upstairs and he goes, "Can I help you?" He could speak English. This is in Belgium. And we go, actually, in making a documentary, I've gone over twice with some filmmakers. So we filmed all this stuff. They go, "Well, yeah, my dad was hidden here in this house during World War II. And he goes, "Really?" So he comes down. And so I had all these pictures that the man who lived there, the couple that lived there at the time, took when my dad was staying, and I was showing him these pictures, and the house looks just like it does today, like it did then. So he invited us in, and then we went to the backyard where I had some pictures, and it goes, "Oh, this is where they were standing, right here." And then I showed him a picture of my dad sitting inside the house on a sofa, and behind him was some wall covering. And the guy says to me, "That wall covering is still there today." So he takes us in, and that wall covering is still there from World War II. And so I sat down and I posed just like my dad, tried to pose just like my dad, and took a picture. So, and on one occasion, the Gestapo pounded on the door at this home, and Maurice Bayou was the man who lived there. He told my dad to get up on the roof. He climbed, went up in the attic, climbed out this little window, and climbed up on top of the roof. And so I went up there in that attic. So you see, you know, where my dad was, it was in this attic, and where the little window he crawled out up and on went up on the tile roof. So I've been in a number of these houses and, you know, in rooms where my dad stayed. So, and, you know, and this happened over a period of time. I didn't find all these places on my first visit. So every time I'd find one of these locations, it'd just be phenomenal. And then the Belgian people that lived there would invite you in and take you up in these haylofts and this barn. And it's just amazing.
Wow. You have had an incredible journey, and to go back and do it, you know, and to see it in real time. One of the things I love about Europe, especially England and France, is the history and how it's still preserved, where you can go through and still almost relive it vicariously, you know, and see where things transpired and what happened. And people take pride. They definitely take pride in the history of what's happened there. And sometimes it goes on through generations. How many of these people are you still in contact? Are you still, you said you're still in contact with the pilot from Germany, but a lot of these Belgian people, they must be like second generation, you know, such as you are. You know, do you guys still keep in touch? And I know you've gone over a couple of times and done quite a few reunions. So is that usually compiled of everybody that you've met that has all been part of this whole journey?
Oh yes. I keep in touch. In fact, I'm this is really my I tell you, it is my passion, believe me. So I have this whole email distribution list of, I don't know, 150 people, either people that live in Belgium or live in the United States or live in the Netherlands, who are some way connected with this story. Because there's other airmen I talk about that weren't part of my dad's crew that are involved in the story, that either survived or did not survive. And I send out periodic emails all the time. So we stay in touch. And on two different reunions, I gathered about 25 relatives of different members, not only my dad's crew, but other airmen that were relatives of airmen that were involved in the story to go over. So we've really built up kind of this family and closeness, which is really, really wonderful. I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgium gentlemen, Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot, who were young boys during the war. And they saw firsthand the atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends. And later in life, they became local historians. And they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information that have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a huge debt. And in 1984, Paul Delahaye formed the American Belgium Foundation to remember and honor these U.S. airmen and allied military men that rescued their country from 4 years of Nazi oppression and Nazi occupation. And they've erected these memorials in the area. And there's one to my dad and his crew that they erected in 1989. And they have ceremonies at this various memorials on the anniversary of their events. One's coming up April 22nd. But Paul Delahaye, he passed away. And now his daughter, Crystal, and her sister, Severine, Crystal's the president of the association now. So they carry on that heritage to remember and honor these U.S. airmen. And the Belgian people people in the Netherlands, they're amazing people. To this day, they're still so thankful and grateful for the Americans and the Allies coming to their rescues because they went through 4 years of occupation. You know, the U.S. people in the U.S. just can't imagine what that was like because they lost all their freedoms for 4 years. So they know the value and, you know, treasure the freedoms that they have today. And they do a great job of educating the younger generations as well. Just wonderful people. I can't talk enough about them. And the big ceremonies are centered around September 2nd, which is the anniversary date of the liberation of Belgium. And they last several days. And all the villagers come out, the U.S., Belgium, French military, the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Belgium comes down with an entourage. And they're just fabulous events. And they have ceremonies at these various memorials. And they have parties and dances and band concerts. And they're just wonderful. I can't wait to go back to the 80th anniversary in 2024.
Wonderful. Hey, Steve, I ordered your book and I'm really looking forward to reading it in more detail. But I have a question. Did your dad talk a lot about his experience when he was in the war and when he was shot down?
Well, that's an excellent question too, because most World War II veterans did not talk about the war.
No, they don't. No, they didn't. And a lot of it was lost. You know, we don't know all the story.
Oh, absolutely. I meet so many people on my travels, you know, and they hardly know anything about their veteran, whether it's a son, daughter, you know, a niece, nephew. Grandchild. And my dad didn't either until 1989, when he and three other members of the crew that were still living went over for the dedication of the memorial to my dad and his crew. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him, revisited these places where he was hidden. And that brought it all back. And he started talking about it after that. Oh, wow. And then, as I mentioned, my first trip was 5 years later. But I still, you know, when you're young, you're busy with your own lives. And it's not until you get older. Although I know, you know, so much about what happened to my dad, I still have 1,000 questions. Yes. I wish I had to ask him, before he passed away.
Yeah. It's the same thing. You know, I do grandparents and they fought in the South Pacific. So I know many times they kind of talked a little bit about it, but I always felt that there was a huge part that I missed in the history because of their perspective of it. And it's, you know, with them gone now, I don't know. And I have to say the information you have on your website, the letters and oh my gosh, it really adds more to the story. It's not lost now. It's preserved. And I can't wait to just read everything in more detail. It's amazing.
So yeah, there's also 200 time period photographs in the book. So you can visualize everything you're reading about, which makes it nice. And many of those pictures were taken by Belgian people during the war in 1944 that were either sent to my dad after the war or that Jacques Lalot or Paul Delahaye provided me during when I was writing the book. So they're one of a kind photographs. And as you say, in the book, included a lot of excerpts from the letters, not only of my dad, but of other crew members or their families. It does make it very personal.
Yeah. How long did it take you to actually, between going through all the letters and interviewing people, how long did it take you to actually compile it all and write the book?
Well, from the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. It took me about 12 months to actually write the manuscript. And then to publish the book, I actually formed my own publishing company called Seabreeze Publishing, which is the name of the street that I live on. And then I contracted with independent professionals for all the associated services, such as editing the book, cover design, interior layout. The book printer I use for the hardcover book is located in Michigan. And then Fulfillment House, who stores the hardcover books and distributes them, is located in Indiana. So it was a real adventure, you know. Because once I wrote the manuscript, I thought, well, now what do I do? So I got a whole education about how to publish a book.
Yeah.
That's a journey in itself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And actually, it's changed my life. I retired and, you know, was just taking it easy, reading books and going for walks and taking naps. And now basically I have a brand new career. I work on, as you mentioned, I go around the country doing a lot of speaking, making PowerPoint presentations, going to air shows. And I'm on the internet every day, involved in social media, and I'm very active in the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association and the 8th Air Force Society. So it really keeps me busy. And like I say, it's a new career, but I love doing it, trying to keep the memory alive and trying to educate the general public, especially younger generations, about what took place and the sacrifice that those, not only the men and women that served in the military, but what the country did at that time to come together and sacrifice and help the war effort.
Yeah. I got one last question for you, because I know you go to the air shows, and have you been up in a B-17? Have you had a chance to fly in one?
Oh, yeah. I've been up twice, and it's a thrill of a lifetime. Talk about getting chills. You know? It's wonderful. Most people, you know, think, well, those were big bombers. But if you actually get inside one, they are so cramped. A B-17 was more cramped than a submarine. I mean, you have to crawl through a lot of the plane. You can't even, you can't even walk or crouch. They're amazing. But to get in one and, you know, have them start the engines and then they start taxiing and then they take off. Oh, yeah. You definitely have chills when you go up in those old warbirds. Mm.
So, Steve, we are going to have all of your links. We're going to have the links to where people can find your book and also where you're going to be speaking and how people can contact you. But just to go ahead and let them know here on air, where can everyone find your book and where's the best way to reach you?
Okay. Well, most people get the book on Amazon. You know, like the vast majority of books that are purchased are on Amazon. And it's in all formats, hardcover and paperback, which has the 200 plus pictures, but also in all forms of an ebook, electronic book, and also as an audio book. If a person wants an autographed copy of my book, they can go to my website, which is stevesnyderauthor.com, Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, stevesnyderauthor.com, and they can, on the homepage, they can order an autographed copy of the hardcover. And as you mentioned, there's a ton of information on my website, just not about the book, but about World War II, the 8th Air Force, and the air war in general. My email address is steve@stevesnyderauthor.com. If anyone wants to ask me, a lot of people contact me and go, you know, is there any, you know, how I can find out more about my veteran? Mm-hmm. So I try to help people find out about their veteran, especially if they were in the 8th Air Force. And then I have a great deal of a great many videos on my YouTube channel, which is Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down, both at air shows. So you see a lot of warbirds taking off or presentations that I've made both here in the U.S. and in Europe. So those are, I'm on Facebook. I have an author page and a personal page, Steve Snyder, Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down. So I'm very active on social media.
Well, we're going to make sure that all of your links and the link to how people can find your book are all incorporated into the podcast. So when you guys are listening to this, just go down in the description and it'll be highlighted and you'll be able to click through all of Steve's links to be able to find all of his books and where he'll be. We have had so much fun with you. And honestly, I could spend hours talking to you and just picking your brain about this, but we're going to have you back. Or Mel and I think we're road trip. Road trip, Northern California. I think we're going to bring our books that we got from you and have you just sign it personally. Take you to lunch, Steve.
that would be a lot of fun. You should do that. Yeah.
I would love that. That was so thank you so much for being with us. And we really appreciate that there's someone like you that is restoring history and taking the time to share insight and information and giving you a little bit of insight what happened outside of what you learn and what you think you know, and to have that personal experience. So I appreciate someone like you because you do give others an opportunity to really experience something that maybe they just didn't know, you know, and you're always learning anyway, but to learn more information that affected you personally and share that is a gift. So thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate you.
Well, thanks again for having me on the podcast. I've had a great time.
All right, guys. So we are looking forward to hearing from you. Please reach out to Steve and buy his book. I think you guys would really enjoy it, especially for those of you that are history buffs. And we appreciate everything that you guys do. And we look forward to seeing you next week. Again, we are just ordinary friends trying to live an extraordinary life. We will see you next week. Bye.
Bye, y'all.